Welcome back to Word Balloon, the pop culture conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, we welcome back Brad Meltzer, best-selling author of The Zero Game, The Tenth Justice, and his 2006 New York Times bestseller, The Book of Fate. Brad is here to talk about his newest novel, The Book of Lies, which weaves together two crimes separated by thousands of years, the biblical parable of Cain killing Abel, and the 1932 murder of Mitchell Siegel, the father of writer Jerry Siegel, who would later create the 20th century's greatest hero, Superman. We talked to Brad about his research and inspirations for the story and some events and causes he's created to bring awareness of the subjects he covers. What gave you the idea for this particular story?
It started in, during my last book tour for The Book of Fate. And I was at this book signing in Florida, and things like this only happen in crazy places like Florida. This older woman stands up, and she hears me talking about Superman and my love of Superman, and she screams out, "I know more about Superman than you'll ever know." And I think to myself, "Listen, lady, there is no way you know more about Superman than I know." And she says to me, "No, I do, because Jerry Siegel, the creator of Superman, is my uncle." And, you know, you'd think at that point I'd take a hint, but I was like, "Oh, okay, you know, he's your uncle, pretty cool." And then another guy, a second later, and again, only in Florida, stands up in the same exact event, and raises his hand, of course doesn't wait for me to call on him, and just blurts out and says, I was with Jerry Siegel in the Army together. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, I'm sitting in this one place in Sarasota, Florida. There's like four people there, and two of them know Jerry Siegel personally. And I kind of took it as a hit over the head. And the nice part was she, who's just a sweetheart and became a dear friend, invited me into the family and really gave me terrific access, introduced me to everyone. And so I had this great Superman side and told me this story that in 1932, Mitchell Siegel, Jerry Siegel's father, was shot and killed. And while mourning the death of his father, his young son came up with the idea for a bulletproof man that he named Superman. And I just love that idea. I love the idea that all these years, if you look at all the interviews, 50 years of interviews, Jerry Siegel never once tells the story that his father was killed in a robbery.
No.
Doesn't tell anyone. In fact, his entire family is told different things. One side of the family is told that it was a heart attack, and the other side of the family is told it's a murder. And nobody knows the truth. And to me, that's a great mystery. That's a great story.
You bet.
And at the same time, the Book of Lies really started 11 years ago when I finished my first novel. And The Tenth Justice had just come out. And I went to pitch my second novel to my editor at the time, and I said, I want to write a story about Cain and Abel and involving Cain and Abel, because I was obsessed with Cain and Abel for the past decade of my life.
Hmm.
And he said to me, "You know what? You're starting out. You just wrote a legal thriller. John Grisham is big now. Don't be a schmuck. Don't be stupid. And you need to go and don't forget Cain and Abel and your nonsense. Write your story. Write another legal thriller." And to be honest, if I were a braver, more impressive person, I guess I would have fought and argued and dreamed my dream. But I was a coward. I was terrified. I had just come out with a book, and I didn't want to lose it all.
Sophomore slump, absolutely. No,
and so I caved, and I changed it. And so when it came to The Book of Lies, I had this story, you know, in Chapter 4 of Genesis, Cain kills Abel. It's arguably the world's most famous murder.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bible is silent about one detail, and that is the murder weapon that Cain uses to kill his brother. In 1932, when Jerry Siegel's father is killed, and he comes up with the idea of this bulletproof man that he named Superman, the murder weapon from that murder is also lost to this day. And the question is, what are these two murders thousands of years apart, one that gives us the world's greatest villain in Cain, and one that gives us the world's greatest hero in Superman, possibly have to do with each other? And that's where The Book of Lies was born.
That's terrific. Now, and I'm a layman when it comes to the Bible. I mean, is the weapon, I mean, as you say, it was never really identified in the Bible, because I was wondering if it was like a Holy Grail or, you know, type of thing in terms
of... No, you know, it was as simple as this. A friend of mine said to me, if you look in the Bible, he says, "You know the story about Adam and Eve and the apple?" And I say, "Sure." He says, "What happened?" I said, "Eve eats the apple, you get kicked out."
Right.
He says, "Yeah, great story, except the word apple never appears in the Bible." So what are you talking about? He says, if you look at the actual translation, forget what modern Bibles in English say today, you look at the real translation, you'll see that the word is actually fig or fruit, some say pomegranate,
okay,
depending on what your translation. It never says apple. When the Greeks translated it into Greek, apples were a sign of virility and strength, so they put the word apple in. And we suddenly have Adam and Eve on their apple rampage. And it just was an amazing little story to me because, you know, you ask 99% of the people what an EV, and they'll say it's an Apple.
Absolutely.
We accept it as fact. That's just part of the lore today. And then they said, okay, now what did Cain kill Abel with? And I said, oh, a rock, a stone. They said, oh, yeah, where does it say that? And sure enough, it doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. It never says anything. It's silent. It just says, you know, Cain kills Abel, and then it goes on the story. So, again, the world's first murder, and there's no murder weapon. Again, to me, a good story.
Absolutely.
And the theory is, when I started kind of digging into it, because sometimes it's just a good story in your head, and then you dig into it and you realize it's a big pile of crap. But the truth is, when you dig into it, it only gets more amazing. And you see theories that say Cain killed him with a rock, some say with a stone, some say with the jawbone of an animal. That's what Shakespeare puts in his play, and that's what Rembrandt puts in his painting. It's a jawbone. Some say that Cain actually bit Abel's throat. That's where we get vampires from.
Wow.
And so it just has all this incredible historical lore built in. And I just, when I was looking at the book, I said, when I have the Superman part, it just seems like it's too geeky even for me, and that's saying something. And when I had the Cain part, it just, you know, 11 years later, it honestly just seemed like some Da Vinci ripoff. But when I put them together and I had the world's, you know, the world's worst villain and the world's greatest hero, and I started examining these stories, it just, I can't put it any other way, but it just started to braid together for me. And I think in a silly way, I just fell down the right set of stairs.
Well, it works out because, yeah, it's... It is an interesting, I wouldn't call it a juxtaposition because it does, it fits. It's a very interesting adventure. And one of the first questions that I have regarding the Siegel and Shuster side is, you use a lot of panels. Most of these are from the books that preceded Action Comics number one, am I correct?
Yeah, well, you know, what I was blown away by is this theory, you know, people saying, how do you know Superman was really inspired by the murder of his father? And there were actually, when I did the research, there were two other versions of Superman before Superman, as we know him, was created.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, even when you look, just even look at the version we know, when Superman first appeared, he didn't have heat ray vision or X-ray vision. He couldn't even fly. All he was bulletproof. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why America got Superman, not because it's the greatest country on Earth, but because a little boy lost his father and wanted a bulletproof man. And that was it. To prove the theory further, as I look back and saw these two other earlier versions of Superman. One of them, in the first one, had Superman as the villain of the story. And the other one, most interestingly to me, was a story that they wrote called The Superman. And what they did in that story was Superman was when it was originally rejected everywhere, Siegel or Shuster, the artist or the writer, no one knows which, destroyed all the pages of the story. So no one's ever seen the story.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that remains is the actual cover. And when you look at the cover, what's happening on the cover of this very first Superman as a Hero story, a man's being robbed exactly in the way that Jerry Siegel's father died weeks earlier. And you don't need to be Freud to play Freud games. But, I mean, come on. It's right there. And then I thought to myself, well, maybe it's still just, you know, me being a geek and my imagination. I went and flew to Cleveland and went back. I was like, let me look at the old newspapers the day after Jerry Siegel's father was murdered. Let's see what this young kid is reading in the newspaper while he's trying to get over the fact his dad was just killed the day before.
You bet.
And I'm flipping through the paper. This is true. This is absolutely true. And I'm going through these old microfiche, and I'm looking at the next day's paper, and I see there that there is a letter to the editor, and the letter is about why the world doesn't need vigilantes anymore. And the letter is signed by A. L. Luther, Lex Luthor. And I'm just, I that's the moment when you get chills, you know, and you just feel like the CIA is now watching because you've figured out and cracked the code. But it's incredible to me. I mean, here it is, the name Luther right in the vigilante article, and the day after his dad dies, there is no way you were telling me that this isn't. And I just was fascinated by that. And it just kind of fed, you know, everything that was happening in my imaginary story. And again, I just started weaving it through and through. And my editor, who hates comic books, my wife, who hates comic books, they just kept saying to me as I was writing the book, was my favorite part is the Superman stuff, which I never knew, I never cared about, and I never thought would be interesting. But it's, you know, for them, it even was more interesting than the Cain and Abel stuff.
Well, and then the book really does put people on a tour of Cleveland, both modern day and back in the 30s, flashbacking to the Siegels, and you get a little bit into the relationship of the father and son. Involving the overall story. But I think it's interesting, and I think it will make people want to go to Cleveland, check some of these things out. Is it the Maltz Jewish History Museum?
Yeah, they play a good big role in it. I haven't even told them yet. I made it sound, you know, far more sexy and terrific than I think that, you know, the exhibit should be. But it's a terrific exhibit, and anyone that is in Cleveland should go to it right now, because it's going to be open at any moment now. And they do, you know, listen, it's still the place where Superman was born. And you know, that to me, the fun of any novel is the real stuff.
Yeah.
I love the fictional stuff, but the real fun, I think, is when you feel like, oh, my gosh, it can really happen. And I, you know, again, the more research I did, the more I found. When I, you know, same thing when I was looking for Kane. I mean, everyone thinks that research is magic. It's not magic. It's just legwork.
Sure.
That's all it is. And it was amazing to me that when I contacted the Siegel family, that Jerry Siegel's daughter said to me, of all the people that have written books about my father, you're the only one that's actually spoken to all of us. And I just thought, my gosh, Superman's more recognized than Abraham Lincoln, and no one's actually speaking to the family to see where we got him from. I mean, we're a country founded on our own legends and myths. And yet we never take the time to figure out where they're really from. And that was the fun. And the same thing with Cain. It's no different. According to most modern Bibles, everyone thinks, you know, Cain is the ultimate bad guy. That's what he's supposed to be. And we think that because his reaction in the Bible is he says to God, my punishment is greater than I can bear. And that's what the text says. And therefore we think, you know, Cain is such a remorseless monster.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go back to the original text, like the Geniza fragments that they found in Cairo, you see that the same passage can just as easily be translated as my sin is too great to forgive. Now he's not this, you know, this guy who has no sympathy. I mean, he's saying, my sin's too great to forgive. I've killed my brother. It's so horrible, you should never forgive me. And there's the difference. In this version, Cain feels so awful and so sorry for what he's done to poor Abel, he tells God he should never be forgiven. And that's a very different view. And suddenly it became far more interesting to me, what if Cain isn't the bad guy in this story? And again, I think in life, sometimes the monsters aren't who we think they are.
You also give us a little glimpse in Cal's, the protagonist's, government background before he gets on the story. Can you tell us about Ice?
Yeah, Ice is you know, one of my favorite acronyms ever to come out of the rearranging of all acronyms. I mean, they used to be, you know, Customs and Border Protection, and now they were like, who wants to be that when they have the initials ICE? And, you know, Immigration, Customs Enforcement, ICE, you know, they just sound like a great Miami Vice spinoff. But I just happened to find the guy who was running some of the parts down here and who took me under his wing and just taught me about it. And I just was fascinated about it. I mean, you know, not just because the ports are sexier because they're cool to write about, it's just especially here in Miami, it's just a real part of the threat to the homeland.
Absolutely. I mean,
that's who's guarding it. And when I started to look around and say, okay, I've written about the Secret Service, I've done the FBI, I've done the CIA, let's see what ICE has to offer. And their jobs are just fascinating, especially when you look at the port and you see how much stuff comes in. I mean, he was telling me this story about, you know, he said, never, ever underestimate what people will do to hide something. I said, what are you talking about? He said, we once found pounds of diamonds that were swallowed by snakes, and they had sewn the anuses of the snakes shut just to hide the diamonds. And I just thought, my gosh, if that's what you're doing with your time and a needle and thread, you know, there is some scary stuff out there. And so the things you see in the book were all based on those real stories I heard. I didn't make them up. They were real.
That's amazing. Well, you know, and that's been in 2004, that was a big election point. Is there enough security and stuff? So, again, a time, I think, as we get closer to November, I think it is going to probably come up again in terms of national security and where we're at right now.
Yeah, no, and listen, it should, because at the end of the day, they do an incredible job, but they can't check every container. They just physically can't do it. There's just a percentage at the end of the day that they say, we're going to check 5%, 10%, 15%. You know, they say we look at 50%, but that's a look at not in the container, that's a look at who's shipping it. So, you know, it's still the greatest hide-and-go-seek, hide-and-spot around.
Wow. Well, let's talk about Siegel and Shuster, because, as you say, interesting that, you know, Siegel's family says that no one has really talked to all of them, because there have been attempts to kind of tell the story of how Superman happened, how they lost control. I look at them specifically, too, as, like, two people of their time, you know, for them to kind of come up with this million-dollar idea, and then also the sadness that they lost the rights to what really should have set them up for the rest of their lives.
You know, listen, you can't help, no matter whether you think that they blew all the money or you think that they were, you know, handled it poorly or you think that they just got screwed. When you tell anyone that the rights to Superman were sold for $130, you can't help but feel that, oh, man, they got screwed. It's just built into the story. And, you know, I think that when you ask me, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster are heroes of mine. And they are heroes of mine not because they invented Superman, not because they made money, not because they had a $1 million idea, but it's because they come from nothing. I just always believe in the greatness that's in everyone. And listen, these guys were so poor, they used to draw on the back of wallpaper. Okay, that's a new level of poor. And they came up with Superman. And I know everyone says, oh, you know, like they're just the first ones and there would have been more Superman. And people forget, yeah, there may have been flying men. There may have been people who had X-ray vision. Someone else may have come up with heat vision, or someone else clearly invented kryptonite on the radio show and all the stories they tell. But what they invented that no one else invented, and to this day no one has because they've only ripped it off, is they invented not just Superman, but they invented Clark Kent. And to me, the most interesting part of the story is not Superman. The interesting part is Clark Kent, the idea that any of us in all our ordinariness, that we're all plain, that we're all boring, that we're all terrified, but we know what it's like to have a moment where we wish we could rip open our shirt and help somebody. And that is a beautiful idea. And that is why all the ripoffs and all the people that they put in capes and put underwear on the outside of their pants and let them fly, all the ones after that, they never had Superman because they never had Clark Kent. And that is what I think resonates. I mean, I think, you know, I believe you don't get the heroes you want in life. You get the heroes you need. And if you look back at the comics that were popular in the Great Depression, there were characters designed to transport you elsewhere, like Buck Rogers and Tarzan, take you to the jungle of the 25th century. After 9/11, you can see that the biggest movie after 9/11 was Spider-Man. And, you know, now suddenly we were a country that was scared again. Just like in World War II, we were scared and Superman was there to protect us. We don't get the heroes we want. We get the heroes we need. And I think, you know, Batman is resonating right now for the same exact reason of people just being fed up of what's going on in the world and wishing they could take it in their own hands. These things are not coincidence. It's not just because the movie's good, because there are a lot of crappy movies that are being made that are doing spectacularly because they're touching something in people, especially on the superhero side. So, you know, Siegel and Shuster, the fact that they did this when they were 17 years old, is, you know, again, these guys are heroes of mine. How do I not write this book as a love letter to them?
There's a neat part of the book. Cal is in the Maltz Museum, and he's listening to an old-time radio show, Fred Allen, Town Hall Tonight, and it seems like it's pretty verbatim, because I've heard that interview before. It's Fred Allen interviewing Jerry Siegel. And, yeah, you really do suddenly realize when he asks him, you know, how old are you? He's like, I'm 25 years old.
Yeah,
and
that's
just
not even
stunning.
When he invented it. I mean,
no.
That's, you know, years later, and that's when they have radio shows and things like that. I mean, and again, you know, people, when they read the book of lies, I think, you know, the constant question I'm getting is it real? And I wish I made up these stories in a strange way because they're so incredible, but I'm just riding on the coattails of these, you know, even for Cain and Abel for Superman, not to put them all, you know, when you put them in the same breath, you suddenly have people saying, oh, my gosh, you know, you're treating them both as these myths and, you know, the religion is not a myth. But you know what? These are the great stories of our time and of ancient times and of modern times. I mean, these, when stories resonate with people, it means something. It's not just entertainment anymore. You don't last that long in just entertainment. And I just always was thrilled to be able to take it and weave a thriller into it. But I wish I made the stories up that, you know, they're there and the reality is there. You just have to show people what really happened.
And the reality is its own entertaining story. And as you say, it informs the myth. And that's the amazing thing about this, because I've heard Siegel talk about the creation of Superman or read about it. And it was always, well, I always wanted a way to get girls. And I thought if I could fly and be strong, then, you know, that was a way. I mean, it was, you know, they kind of reinvented themselves as the years went along. And
yeah,
I think it has...
Someone said very well, Jerry Siegel knew the value of a good story. And what's the better story? Two poor kids from Cleveland in the Great Depression invent the greatest hero of our time? Or a little kid is really weak and lost his father and misses him? It's just a... You know, we want to come, as Americans, from places of strength. We don't want to come from places of vulnerability. But, again, I think especially now, look at the candidates that we've nominated for president. They are both heroes. They are both, I mean, one physically taking down the enemy with his bare knuckles. The other one, a symbol of hope and of a new day. I mean, they just might as well be wearing capes and utility belts. It's unbelievable, and I think it is because we again are at a place where we want someone to save us.
As you dabble in the world of comic book writing, you have really, you know, made the Superman story such an important part of this book. I think comic book fans are really going to be interested and surprised and learn a lot. And even jaded fans, like, you know, yourself, as you said, when you were in Florida at the book signing and, you know, his niece raised her hand and suddenly you found out things that you never thought you'd find out before about the story behind Superman.
I hope so, Bal. I really do, because that's, you know, listen, that's, you can share that story with people. That's, you know, that would be fantastic.
I understand a trailer is being made to help promote the book.
Yeah, we have a little trailer that we put together, and people are finally starting to see. And we got a couple people that are starring in it: Joss Whedon, Damon Lindelof, Brian K. Vaughan, Christopher Hitchens. And my buddy A.J. Jacobs all volunteered to cut their usual wages and work for the True Peanuts and come down to the novel world of things. And obviously, it, you know, this is one of those geek dreams come true because you get to work with all your heroes. And I didn't know if we were going to be able to pull it off. And, it just has really been one of the most fun, ridiculous, rewarding, and pathetically exciting moments for me when it comes to all these books, because there is nothing, you know, someone told me, never meet your heroes. They will always let you down. And in this case, it only got better.
That's a pretty diverse group of people, actually. I mean, there's some similarities. There's a thread there, but Hitchens and Tom and Jacobs,
listen,
actually.
We can't be completely predictable.
Okay. Well, you know, and again, is this the trailer? Does it revolve around the myth behind the book, or is it?
No. You'll see that half of them are talking about the book being real, and half of them are talking about how it's just a big fat lie, and it's not even in the Bible. And why would you believe that? And I don't think it's going to take many guesses to figure out which is which. But it certainly has been fun. And what we've also done is you'll see at the end of the trailer, you get to see a little bit about the book and some of Ellis's diary and where it comes from.
Well, and I know the Maltz Museum plays a part in the book. Another important landmark in the book is Jerry Siegel's home, which is still in Cleveland, but apparently not in the best of shape right now.
Yeah, you know, when I was researching the book, I went to Cleveland. I wanted to see the house where Superman was created. It seemed like it was an important part for the Book of Lies. And I got there all excited because, you know, the house that Google was founded and is protected. The garage where Hewlett Packard is founded is preserved. Richard Nixon's house is a museum. And I got to Jerry Siegel's house, and it's a wreck. The house where Superman was created is wrecked. And a family lives there, a kind African-American couple, sweet as can be, nicest people in the world, but they don't have the money to take care of this house. I mean, and I'm not talking about, oh, it's just, you know, it just needs a little cleanup. I'm talking about there are gaping holes in the wall.
Wow.
There, you know, you can literally look through, as it's described in the book, is real. You can look through the ceiling and you can see the floor underneath because the plaster's all gone. And some of it, you know, they're hanging their clothes in the boards that are underneath. It's an incredible disaster. And I just thought, this is awful. This is horrible. Here's a character, as I said before, that's more recognized than Abraham Lincoln. And with, you know, almost like Cleveland has just completely disrespected that fact. I mean, they built a museum to rock and roll, which they have no claim to, but their most famous resident, their most famous creation, and they just kind of like let it go to hell. And I just think it's horrible. So, you know, to me, I made a couple phone calls, and we basically got a couple people together, and Cleveland was, you know, there were a couple people locally who said, we want to save this house and in the city of Glenville, and we kind of just had our own little team up and started calling around, and suddenly we, you know, were able to get, and you'll see it if you go to ordinarypeoplechangetheworld.com, you'll see this auction that we put together, and it has everyone from Stephen Colbert to Brian Bendis to Jim Lee to Neil Gaiman. We got Adam Kubert. I mean, you name it, and we, you know, over and over, people just started donating art and donating things and asking, what could I do next? And it was just overwhelming. It was clear to me that all these other organizations let this place languish. The local government, the skeevy politicians, all the people that show up for the red tape cutting ceremony,
yeah,
they didn't do anything. Who's going to do it? We're going to do it. we're going to do it ourselves, or at least we're going to try. And if we fail, you know what, it's better to at least try, and how could I not believe in that?
Well, that's great. Now, it is already underway. It began September 2nd.
Yeah, it hits September 2nd, and, you know, we have Chip Kidd, the great graphic designer, doing the T-shirts. I mean, even if everyone just goes and buys, listen, it's going to be hard to bid on Jim Lee drawing you with Superman, which is what he's donating. I mean,
wow.
You know, that's going to take a lot of money for someone to win, I hope. But even if you just buy one T-shirt, if you, you know, just mail it along to one person, buy one T-shirt, buy it for a friend, you know, if we just did that, we're going to raise a lot of money for this house. All the proceeds, all the profits go to to help the Siegel House. And, you know, we're just doing it because I think it's, you know, are there better causes? Yes. Are there better people that, you know, better ways to save people? Sure. But it matters. It matters that Superman was created there. It matters. And I just think we should not be disrespectful of that.
Is the hope to restore the house to look like a period piece and be a kind of museum?
Because you know, if you go to the house right now, it is painted bright blue and red, Superman colors. you know, and it's, you know, and look, three doors down, four doors down, there's a boarded up house with a giant sign that says no copper piping inside, only PVC. I mean, it's that neighborhood.
Okay.
So it's a rough neighborhood, and the goal is, of course, to restore it to its old glory. And, you know, our ideal is, you know, right now we're fixing up for the family who lives there. I think that that's fantastic. The long-term goal, if you ask me, and again, it's still being discussed, is, listen, I'd love if one day a bus full of kids could come from anywhere in the Midwest or anywhere that wants to drive there, could stop at that house and tour it and see where, a little boy dreamed up Superman. And you'd have kids' art hung around the whole house. I mean, that to me is a beautiful picture. But, again, it's all going to depend on how much money we raise and how far we get. Right now, we have a very simple, small goal, and that's just let's repair the roof. Let's get rid of the paint that's rotting on the outside, because those are the things that if you don't take care of now, the house will not be there long. Joe Shuster's house is knocked down and gone. It was in such disrepair.
Wow.
So, you know, again, would I love to restore the old radio room that they used to listen to the radio to? Yes. But right now I just want to get all the snow out from coming through the roof.
The site for the auction is called ordinarypeoplechangetheworld.com or .org?
Ordinarypeoplechangetheworld.com. And you know, my wife teases me and says, you know, that this is my new religion. And, you know, maybe it kind of is, you know, but I really do believe in it. I believe ordinary people change the world. You know, it doesn't matter to me where you went to school or how good looking you are or how much money you have. That's all nonsense. What I believe in is regular, normal people. I believe the greatness that's within everyone. I believe in the Wright brothers that when they went out to fly their plane, they used to bring enough for three crashes every time. Every time they went out, they would bring enough. They knew they were going to fail. They knew every time, not just fail once, but three times, every time they went out. But they kept going out, and they kept going out, and that's the only reason they took off. And I believe in that. I just believe that it's the ordinary people who change the world. I believe in Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster creating Superman, or I believe in Mr. Rogers, just a kid who had bad allergies, used to stay inside and play with his piano and his hand puppets because his allergies were so bad. And I love that. So, you know, we launched this website called Ordinary People Change the World, and, you know, it's not there to sell books, and it's not there to do anything, and maybe it is me going a little crazy and trying to put a little bit of a different word out there, but I've been so lucky for these, you know, this past decade of the people that have supported the books and that have supported our TV work and have supported all the things I've worked on, that I felt like, how can I not put something good and positive out there back? And is it naive? Yes, it's naive. And is it silly? Yes, it's a little bit silly. But, you know, I believe in it, and that's all I can possibly say about it because, you know, that's what matters.
Well, I know the comic book side of your fans have kind of risen to the occasion when, you know, artists have fallen on bad times, and we've got things like the Hero Initiative that tries to help out creators that, you know, just need a hand. So I think this is great, and it sounds like, you know, based on some of the things that you've got for auction, you know, it's going to, you know, that's a great idea. And
yeah, I mean, you know, ever since we started, my wife and I have been supporting a few key charities, and this was just our chance to try and let other people support those as well if they want to. And, you know, there are just great causes out there that don't get all the big money and don't get all the recognition. And, you know, it's just a place for people to go and every once in a while take a breath and realize, you know what, you know, you do have to kind of sniff that rose every once in a while.
Now, there's a soundtrack for the book?
Yeah. there's a novel, does a thriller really need a soundtrack? No, it does not. But neither does a movie or a TV show. But when you pull on those manipulative strings and music starts tugging on you, you sometimes get something that's really mesmerizing. And so we built a soundtrack. Sony Music had someone, and I will say it's amazing. I love it. We got to pick some great songs. We're teaming up with R.E.M. We have the theme from The Greatest American Hero. We have Bonnie Tyler, Holding Out for a Hero.
Nice.
We have Five for Fighting. You know, so we have these great Superman songs. But we also have what I think is just fascinating. And I should say we have a song called The Book of Lies, which is just cool because there is nothing like hearing someone sing a song of your book. I mean, you know, I've been lucky and fortunate to do some cool things, but there's nothing like hearing someone sing a song about a book you wrote. And at the end of the soundtrack, what the other half of it is we, Sony actually had someone score the book.
Wow.
So they went through and, you know, in chapter one, and when you watch what happens to Cal's mother, and when you watch what happens to Cal, and you get to the key scenes, they actually went through and put instrumental music in and sent it to me. I basically took half the list, threw it away, didn't like it, didn't match. And we went back and forth and back and forth until we got something that you can literally put on, you know, chapter one of the book, hit play, and you'll be taken through the emotional moment of, you know, as close as what you can get to what I'm hearing in my head as I write the scene. And I think it's a really cool experiment. So you can get it on iTunes or you can get it on Amazon, and it's really been a lot of fun for me.
Who's the composer for the score?
It's a variety of them. There's
Tons
of people. I mean, there's this guy Wagner. We think he's going to be a big hit one day. Not so big with the Jews, but, you know, that's the way it goes. And but, you know, some guys you might have heard of.
Okay, so it's source music. I wasn't sure if they...
Yeah, no.
Okay.
It's nothing that you probably have ever heard of, because we just didn't want, you know, you can't take the big stuff, but we kind of took the minor stuff you didn't know. And
that's great. That. Well, the Book of Lies, who performed that?
The Book of Lies was written and sung by Robert Ellis Orrell, who is this incredible songwriter and has written, you know, number one after number one song, and for some reason just said, I need to do something really pathetic, and so he decided to come and work on our novel.
Did you talk to him about the, you know, I mean...
I wish I could say, yes, we spoke for days, and, you know, we totally got the theme right, but basically they were like, here's a really good guy. He wrote a number one. You in? And I was like, I'm in. And they said, here's your song. And, you know, it was, I guess I could have said, boy, that sucks and let's go back. But it wasn't like that. It really was something that was pretty fun. And, it, you know, and my wife listened to it and said, I like this song. And I was like, good, because it's ours.
That's really cool. I can't think of a time where I've ever heard of a soundtrack for a book, but I think that's great. It's like when I walk into a DVD shop, when they turn off the voice track of the film and you just got the score. And it really is amazing how just the mood of the music really does pull you into whatever is going on. So I think that's wonderful.
You know, Shawshank Redemption, just watch, and next time listen to the music, it'll blow your mind.
We all love Jack and Bobby, your fine show for the WB, and I understand that you have a new TV project in the works?
Yeah, I've been working on one for the past couple of months in seclusion, but with Jeff Marks, who did Avenue Q.
Oh, great.
And Marco Panette, who's one of the guys who used to work on Ugly Betty, and I have working on a show with the same Jack and Bobby team, myself and Steve Cohen. And it's basically the story of the greatest, biggest band in the world, bigger than the Beatles, bigger than anybody, and they're called the Romeos. They're going to be the biggest band of all time. They're going to write the songs that people make love to and that you dance with your kids at their weddings to and that you bury your family members to. But right now, they're just graduating high school. They're just four boys. And this is the story of how these boys become men. So it has a little bit of a Jack and Bobby feel, but for us, it's set in the 60s and kind of plays with very much that time period. Because if you look at the late 60s and you look at the time period now, the overlaps are uncanny. And you'll hopefully see the Romeos at some point, but right now we're still writing the script, so we've got a long way to go.
Wow, that's great, man. It's a cheesy movie called Birth of the Beatles, and I think Dick Clark produced it, and I think it was a made-for-television movie. But you go back to those early days, and I mean, I think you're right. I think the genesis of something like that is a really fertile place for stories. And I mean, the Beatles themselves in the Beatles anthology, you heard the stories of them carousing
and stuff.
Sure, the
stories are spectacular. You know, but the other part of it is for me is, you know, when I look at the stories of the Beatles and when I look at even, you know, again, they're not the Beatles, but, you know, they're still as big as you get these days, U2, what fascinates me is Listen, I love seeing those shots over and over, the girls pulling their hair out and screaming and, you know, riding up bed sheets just to get up to the hotel room. But I love even more the idea that it were just four kids from Liverpool, four boys from Dublin. And they just, you know, just you and your buddies. And no matter, you know, how big Bono gets it, you know, and he can dump them all and leave them behind, he doesn't. I just love that that friendship runs deeper than the success. And there's just a real story behind that. It doesn't just happen because you're nice. It happens because something ties the four of you together in a way that, you know, it becomes family. And we, again, thought it was just totally right for stealing and using for our own TV show.
That's really cool, man. Oh, I hope you get good music, people.
I hope so. Listen, we got a long way to go, but we're trying.
That's great.
Bye.
Very cool. That's really cool. Well, Brad, it's another great adventure story. The mystery is great. You're obviously a puzzle fan, and I always find that really interesting as well, that you allow your readers to really look at the clues as well.
My first job was Games Magazine, the Puzzle and Game Magazine.
That's right.
And guys from there actually helped me with the puzzle in this one, so I'm not that stupid. The best puzzles are the ones that are played fair.
Well, this is another interactive kind of adventure that way. And, again, two very disparate subjects, but you found a way to weave them together into a very interesting story. And then, of course, there's Cal's own journey as well with his father as part of the book. So it's called The Book of Lies, and it's out now, and it's another exciting thriller from Brad Meltzer. And, Brad, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Cal.
That's author Brad Meltzer. His latest novel, The Book of Lies, is available in hardback from Grand Central Publishing. That's all the time we have for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks for listening. This is John Suntress. For more podcast interviews with today's pop culture creators, you can find Word Balloon in the podcast section of iTunes and our website, wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.